Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to return to the Pleasure Palace of the Pirate Prince, which is our dungeon design dash that we did last week at Rising Phoenix Game Con. You know, Paul and I each did a separate playtest on separate days with different players, and they were both great in different ways. So we're going to talk about that and a whole lot more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin today's discussion, I will remind everyone that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That's a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account all set up over there by the end of the show, and maybe about 10 minutes after the hour, Dan and I will be there to talk to you all live.
We love that every week. We have the best patrons, thanks to our patrons such as Vacrius, who's currently checking in that we are live on Twitch and YouTube and Restreambot. Thank you so much for that. Glad to see everybody here today. Man, Paul, I had a great time at Rising Phoenix Game Con last weekend. They're wonderful hosts. They have a wonderful vibe there in Milford, Massachusetts. And I cannot appreciate what a good job they do putting that on every year.
Yeah, it's a great convention. Definitely highly recommend it. You know, the only complaint is it's getting big, man. That thing is starting to exceed the bounds of the space and the time that they've given it. I won't be surprised if that doesn't expand temporally and possibly spatially. They're you know, they host. I think this is the first year I went where I arrived mid afternoon, late or early evening on Friday, and the parking lot was already packed. And
yes,
they kind of informally have had games on Thursday, and I think the informally part is likely to go away. This might become a 4-day con, and who knows, maybe they'll have to look for a new location if they start really burst at the seams over there.
I was talking a little bit with our friend Scott, who I think is what, president or CEO or whatever his official title is, and he was like, I wish we had a couple extra game rooms. I wish we had a couple extra rooms here. We have pretty much stuffed this particular conference area up. You know, it's funny because at GaryCon, you know, they had to take over an indoor water park, right? And they shut down the water park and they just stuffed more tables and put all the pirate themed things in there. So I don't know if that particular hotel in Milford does have a pool. So I don't know if they need to take over the pool area, start shoving some game tables in around there or not.
Stick some tables in there. It's a little. Yeah, I could run the WDM scheme that features the green dragon for the little chlorine gas.
Yeah, it's pretty chloriney in there. Yeah, I did. I took a siesta at one point, and yeah, that one thing is it's a little chloriney in there. But what they're doing great work there, and they're very successful, and just everybody that goes there has a great time.
Yeah, definitely recommend. Check it out next year, folks. It's great fun. So, Dan, you and I ran as usual. It seems this is our new pattern here at these game conventions. We ran another Dungeon Design Dash, number 8.
Yeah.
And we, for the first time, we did the thing that I was discussing at the last one, which was at the very end, we renamed it, right? Because we use these lovely tables from Matt Finch that are really inspirational, but we tend to twist on those ideas, and they usually introduce maybe the main villain in a way that's kind of spoilery. So we started doing a thing where at the end we ask everybody to in the room or on chat to rename it, and we ended up with the Pleasure Palace of the Pirate Prince, which
Say
is
that
really misleading.
I needed to practice that title before we started the show today is what I realized outset. And you know, the funny thing, so one thing I'm gonna say, I think we're doing better at it. I mean, I could be totally insane, but I think we're doing a better job with it. And I myself am actually enjoying it more as we do it. Mm-hmm. And the audience, the audience energy at RPGCon was I would say the best so far. I had so much. I just had such a good time with the folks in that room. added so much to it. And even this idea of revisiting the title at the end of the hour was itself a suggestion from someone at GaryCon. So yep. those little gems from the audience are just totally invaluable to making this a better experience all the time.
Yeah. It was a lively audience. I was really excited to be there. And, you know, we had a good mix of folks both in the room and on the chat offering suggestions. And the dungeon just kind of came together, right? Like that was, I think it was the very last room where you absolutely insisted that we roll on some tables. We hadn't. Every room just kind of flowed together and made sense.
Yeah, it did. I didn't expect that. That's totally the first time that happened, but just like everything, I guess sometimes you hear about writers talking about like, oh, the characters take over and then it just becomes inevitable what's going to happen. And that was exactly our experience from designing the Pirate Prince adventure. It was kind of odd to have that take off. Like it was almost a little uncanny, frankly, experiencing what was happening. I don't know if that came through if you're watching the show or not.
I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed running it too. It's a solid adventure, honestly. I think it's a very solid adventure and I would run it again.
I agree, and I would say that there's one encounter that's actually maybe my favorite thing to run that I've ever had a hand in designing, actually. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but I was like, there's one encounter here that really nailed it for me at the table.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll be curious to hear what that is. Now, Dan, we both ran the game. We talked about, I can't remember if we talked about it here on the show or not, but we talked about potentially opening the door to co-DMing the game because our two games were scheduled at totally different times. And we didn't end up doing that.
We debated that a bit. That was not an easy call. That was actually kind of a hard call because both ways would have been good, but we wound up partly I was the one that pulled the plug on that, to be honest. Yeah. Narrowly calling it there to run it separately.
I will say the nice thing though was just having that idea in the back of our heads, I think led us possibly to adding more encounters that were with intelligent creatures that we could, you know, do some NPC roleplay with.
This was really packed with almost everything in the dungeon was potentially communicable with in a lot of ways, and that made for a very interesting play experience. I will say that I think part of the thing that pushed me on the side of doing it separately is, you know, we're improvising a lot of it the night that we produce it, which was Friday night at RPGCon, and then, you know, we had a discussion in the hotel room later that night as we're both kind of brushing up some details to make it workable because I was going to run it on Saturday. And, you know, there's some stuff that we're going to leave a little bit in the hands of the DM at the table to fill in or improvise at the time. And as we discovered, there was some stuff that we had in the text that we absolutely interpreted differently in our two play tests. And I know from when we've done stuff in the past, that was one of those instances where we were going to trip over each other. If we'd done it as a co-DM type thing. So at least the first time, I don't mind separate clean room testing.
Certainly the door's open. We could always run this again at another con in a co-DM style. I think that might be fun.
I think that would be the thing to do, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and another interesting thing that came up out of this is I had some discussions with some of the folks on the board of the convention discussing this, the panel, and then the adventures that we ran. And the suggestion was made that perhaps we should really live stream the games to the channel so that people can see us playing. And I immediately pointed out, well, you're in a big, you know, ballroom, it's very loud, there's a lot of moving, you know, people moving around and whatnot. There's a lot outside our control that would make it very difficult to live stream. And I was immediately countered with the idea of like, well, we'll just get you a private room. Just get you a private room, Dan. Well, you can run your game live stream from a private room. How about that?
At which point, as good improvisers, we're required to say yes.
Yes, yes, and yes, very much. Thank you.
Next time,
yes.
We need to get everybody's buy-in. We need to get everybody's buy-in that they're going to be online playing live. That's the amazing instincts of the folks running RPGCon. They get to that wonderful idea much faster than we do. So yeah, that's a possibility. We should do that.
Yeah. We'll have to look into that next year.
Absolutely. And I will say, and a good point, because some of the rooms are, you know, if you've been to conventions, this tends to happen. Some of the rooms were loud, a number of us, and then you wind up kind of slightly competing for on volume level. Scott was very nice that he put us, like both of all of our games, Paul, were right in the center table of the room where we were, which was great.
You think but that's then a we kindness? Had it all.
It's kind of like a little bit of a spotlight space. Yeah. So I liked it, but we were competing. Like all of us were having voice trouble. All of us were hoarse.
Yeah,
that night.
Now you're in the center of the room like that. Uh-huh. I think you get the most of the noise. Unfortunately. Regardless, let's should we talk about the runs, the actual games that we play to this?
And for we should, and viewers, spoilers. Yeah. Okay, so if you think you're going to be a player at some point, because your DM watches the channel is going to be running you through the pleasure palace of the Pirate Prince. Just be aware we're gonna in detail talk about spoilers. Obviously, if you watch the design session, you already got 90% of this. But yes, yep. I want to hash this out, Paul.
And now that's an interesting thing that we have to contend with every year that I'm still personally not satisfied with, which is that inevitably some players will come to the design dash and watch it and then come and play in one of the sessions afterwards. And then, you know, it's never been a problem. They're always, you know, very gracious about it. No, I'll just keep quiet and stay in the back and I'll participate, but I won't give away any secrets or really like try to steer the group in any directions, which is always nice. But on the other hand, what I always point out is these are the most engaged people. These are the people who are most excited to be at the table because they've been through the whole thing. And it's a shame to have to ask them to do that, right? I would rather them be, you know, the leaders of the group because that's clearly the type of person they are.
Yeah. Yep. That's, you know, it's a time. Obviously, we need to embrace that. And it is truly a treasure that, I don't know, I guess I didn't foresee this being a problem, but it's truly a treasure that some folks are excited enough to check out what we're doing, that they're going to do that. And everyone that has done that, I mean, they tend to be DMs themselves. So they're aware of the possible traps in this kind of play environment. And every single one of them has understood, yes, I'm not going to blurt out the answer to the puzzles. I'm not going to blurt out what's on the left versus the right passage. It's worked out really great every time. But there's going to be, and you have one less mind in the mix to solve the puzzles. But it has worked. It's worked great so far.
All right, Dan, I'm going to put up the map. So this is going to begin the spoilers here because folks will see the secret doors and such. But
yes,
put up the map and we can talk a little bit about some of the areas. Now, I'm curious. We talked a little bit at the beginning there that there's a lot more possibility of social encounters in here. How many did you actually have? How many cases did you have the players trying to negotiate with the monsters before combat began?
Well, that's interesting. Certainly the mermaids at 3 we were communicating with. It was getting close to the end of the session for me, so I was starting to abbreviate and kind of push the pace forward a bit. But I had a really surprisingly fun time running the big bunch of mermaids in 3, interacting with them. I think maybe that was largely it, actually. They could have, I guess, we have the vampire pirate in 6. And time was running out, and so I made a big deal of him just standing up and giving a rather clear monologue of his intent. He's like, "Finally, my hunger can be satiated, and foolish adventurers come here. I will drink your blood. I will regain my power, and I will take over the islands." And then at that moment, the wizard player on my left said, I interrupt his monologue and fireball him. So that was all I got. That was all I got with the vampire. Nice.
I also had an interaction with the mermaids at three, similar to yours, I think, and probably inspired by yours because you were so glowing about that encounter. And not my run came later than yours. Now that is where my players entered the dungeon. So that is the very first encounter I ran was with the mermaids. And they used a remind spell and just their general nature as they knew something was up, something was not right with what the mermaids were saying. But they used it as a means of just kind of sliding by and getting into the dungeon without having any conflict. You don't need to fight the mermaids. Yeah. So that was interesting. And then my players encountered the main villain who, here's big spoiler, right, is not the pirate prince. He's not the mastermind here. In fact, there is a spirit Naga who's controlling people through magic mirrors placed strategically throughout the dungeon. So I actually had them encounter her through a mirror in seven. And she managed to charm one of the players and was trying to turn all the players into her minions. Which did not go so well for her. So that was a little bit of a taste of a social encounter there, I guess.
I agree with that. And you told me about that after. I didn't foresee that use of the spirit Naga actually communicating with the players through the mirror. I guess I want to say I overlooked that. So when my players got to that 7E location, I gave them a hint like, maybe you think you see something spooky through the mirror as you investigate it. Was all I did. And then when you told me what you'd done, I was like, oh, that's much better. I should have done that. That's a lot better. Now, one thing I'll say.
Fun. The mirrors definitely struck me during the design phase. I thought the mirrors were, oh, this is a nice way that they can encounter the enemy without actually, like where combat's not even on the table, right? They can't really combat it. It's just going to talk.
Yeah. That's super. And I mean, give us a little bit more detail about how that played out, Paul. Remind me exactly how that played out with the.
So the area at seven, of course, is full of the lizard men who worship the spirit Naga as a something of a god, right? She's charmed them all. They are her loyal minions. Now my group came in through three, as mentioned, fought the pirate prince there. I think what number is that? Six. Found the secret door through to 11. Came up the hallway and then burst into seven. Now they weren't attempting to be stealthy, but nor were they were they making a ton of noise approaching it. They just burst in. So I did some surprise rolls. No one was surprised. I was like, all right, it's fight time. I did assume actually that the lizard men were aware that the party was in the dungeon because, of course, they're speaking with the spirit Naga, who had previously also been communicating telepathically with the mermaids. So they're well aware that they're being invaded. So they were ready for a fight. So we have this whole big fight in seven with the lizard men and the players. And then finally, one of my players then goes up there to look and gaze at the mirror. So I have the Naga appear there and immediately, you know, uses, you know, says, oh, you know, I can't even remember what I had her say, but something like, oh, welcome, you know, welcome my faithful minion to my domain. I'm so glad that you are here, right? And then uses her charm effect through the mirror, which my player failed the saving throw on. And so then I proceeded to lay it on thick and say, who are your friends? Introduce me to your friends, please. Because she's well aware, of course, that she just lost her whole troop of lizard folk. Might as well take on the victors.
Level up.
Their new minions. Yeah. And again, I think it was in my head here, too, that the false title, right, the original inspiration was literally had the word minions in it, right? It was like,
yes.
What was it, like the seaweed?
Right.
I don't remember what the actual title was. What was it, Dan? It was something seaweed.
That's a good
question.
Seaweed minions of the hive of the something?
So the seaweed hive of the minions of the Naga, right?
That's there you go. Yes, that's what it was.
Yep. And so I was like, she definitely wants more minions. The players were having nothing to do with it. So the other players kind of start flanking. And they're doing this, literally doing this at the table. They're like, yeah, I kind of come up on the side, and then they got their strongest warriors on either side of the mirror, and they heave it down, literally on top of the player who's there, saying, hey guys, this is great, whatever, blah blah blah, right? And they smack him. He takes some damage. And then they haul it on over to the opening into the sea, and they chuck it out the window. They're like, no, out, no magic, get it out, hurl it into the sea.
That's great. I love, kudos to the player, right? Kudos to the charm player for playing through with that. Not 100% of people in the world would. So that sounds fantastic. And there's something neat about the opening of the sea at seven, because, so for starters, I'll say my group the day before, our two groups took totally different approaches in. And, when we start out, you can potentially you could land, right? There's three places you could land at, either area one or three or seven. And one has this big, open, apparently safe beach, but no entry point from there. And then three has a pier, but it's broken off. And then seven is just something's been shattered right into the hallway in seven, but there's a bunch of like possibly dangerous rocks there. So I think, Paul, with your group, they actually landed where?
They landed right at three. It was just too inviting. They were like, nope, that looks perfect. Great. We can row our boat right on over there. We can tie it up. Wonderful. This is what we want. Now, they had one player with them who had a helm of underwater action. And so, and they had another player who had a flying broom. So they were mostly piled into the rowboat approaching this thing, but they had a little air support from their mage on a broom of flying, and they had tied a rope off to their fighter magic user who had the helm of underwater action, who was walking on the floor of the ocean via line to approach. Yeah.
That's great.
That was their approach. So they were well aware of the mermaids, right? The person underwater saw the mermaids and was like, "Oh God, mermaids!" Right? And so he climbed up the rope and climbed the boat. Said, "Guys, there's mermaids under there."
Right. Can I say that so I've never thought about this entirely in my life until you just said that. But now I want in my campaigns, I want the helm of underwater action to be canonically one of those big, huge, ancient diving helmets.
Right. Honestly, how I've always thought of it. That is exactly how I've always thought of it.
Oh, my God.
Maybe I don't quite go overboard with that. But okay. I do say that, like, it allows you to move through water as if the water is air. So it's not like you're not an expert swimmer, but you can walk on the floor because you're just walking around. Like, yeah. Always kind of assumed it was sort of like that. Yeah.
So anyway, so Paul's group, so you land at three and they went through 3, 4, 5, 6 vampire and then secret door 11, 10, 7, 8, 9 lizard men and the Naga. So my group did it almost exactly reverse. So what they did is they landed at one, they landed at the safe beach at one, and then their overwhelming desire was to climb up over the top of the island. So I had four players for what it was worth. One of them's a halfling thief. And they were, and I actually kind of made it tough there because I described all the cliffs as glassy quartz. And I gave them two attempts for what it's worth. Two was going to be the number. On the second attempt, the halfling thief did climb up the 100 feet to the top of the bluff, threw down a rope. The rest of them went up over, and then they were scouring the top of the bluff looking for entryways from there. And I said, well, it's grassy. There's a withered tree. You check it around. There's a couple nests of seabirds. They take off and now they're circling the island. They're squawking angrily, but you're really convinced there's nothing up here. And then what they did, they rappelled down into seven and they threw a rope down, rappelled down the cliff into seven, did catch the lizardmen by surprise, right? And then they went 7, 8, 9, fight the Naga, and then went the other way and didn't get to the mermaid's vampire until the last hour. So that was a fascinating, reversal in how the parties approached it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's great. Now I want to call out one thing, just kind of a mechanical thing. And maybe this is worth putting, a picture up here. This is Dan's game where Dan has this massive wet erase battle mat, which conveniently completely, was exactly the right size to hold the entire map. And like, how did you realize that?
It was late night on Friday, so it was after. Mm-hmm. And I mean, normal. So you, Paul, normally prep the design dashes. I don't see the Dyson Logos map that you've picked out until basically we do it. And so after the design session, probably after midnight, some point, I was sitting in bed and I was like, wait a minute, I think that's actually going to fit on my map, even at the 1 inch per 5 feet scale. And I was like, oh, that's delightful. And I do have this giant, it's from Chessex. It's called the Mega Map. It's 32 inches by 46 inches. So it's almost 3 by 4 feet. And I was like, this is great. I'm just going to draw the island around the whole exterior of my map and then just fill the thing in continuous as we go. You know, it's funny because you and I both, Paul, say that we intend to do stuff theater of the mind, but we have the battle map if we want to. And like at GaryCon, I actually got a little bit of static from players with the battle map out and not initially using it. And so I might be, I don't know, am I evolving into a state where I'm using the battle map more and more? But the fact that I could have it continuously out and kind of give everybody a topographical sense of where they are just felt really, yep, really right. And I was just kind of this magical, kind of just this magical thing that fit that particular game.
That's very cool. I love that worked out for you like that. I think that's super neat, right? And I'm reminded of, there's certain things that I like using it for. I still lean in the direction of I would rather do theater of the mind. I would rather not be moving miniatures around. But, you know, and as soon as it gets even remotely complex, then I'm like, okay, let's draw, right? And yeah, remotely complex, I mean, either in combat because we're split up and there's different groups and we need to track that, or sometimes just because, like, you know what, the shape of this room is really annoying and it's difficult to describe, yeah, and it's just going to be easier if I just draw it for you. So both of those are cases where I'm like, all right, fine, I'll just draw. Now, what I did something slightly different here, but I still, when I was looking at the map here, I'm going to put the map back up. Right, I think one of the most important things is at the very beginning of the game, that the players are on a boat. I think we both just assume players are approaching this on a boat. So I wanted to like describe, like I would assume any party worth their salt, right? The first thing you're going to do is circumnavigate the island and scope it out, right? Where are the entrances? Mm-hmm. Where do we land, etc. So I thought it was important to describe 1, 3, and 7, right? At 1, you have a nice placid beach, great place to land, but doesn't seem to go anywhere. At 3, you've got an old decrepit pier that's sticking out. Like, clearly this is meant for boats to land here. But maybe, you know, again, good players are going to be like, well, that's a trap, right? And then 7, you've got some of the rock is starting to give way, and you can see some man-made openings into some man-made space, but the water is very rough here, right? There's swirling currents and there's rocks and it looks very dangerous. So I wanted to describe this, and ultimately what I ended up doing was I took a piece of graph paper and I'm like, I'm going to just draw the outline of the island so I can show it to the players. Say, here, you're landing. And I set it on top of the map in front of me and I went, oh, I think my grid just completely lines up. And so then I just traced it. I just traced the outline onto my piece of graph paper. And I'm like, oh, perfect. Oh. I didn't have to do anything inventive here. I just traced it. And then I thought, oh, right. Here's a trick I've done before in the past. And I do this for, actually, originally saw this done when I played Palace of the Vampire Queen with run by Frank Mentzer. And then later I've done this with House on Hangman's Hill, where I literally just give the players, here on graph paper is the outline of the space you're about to go in.
Yeah.
This is yours now. You can fill this in as you see fit. And I did exactly that. And I loved it. Except that I was wrong, Dan. The grid lines did not match up perfectly. I didn't quite realize that until they were starting to explore. And I went, oh no, that hallway doesn't actually fit. Oh crap. Yeah. It wasn't the worst. But nevertheless, I do actually think what I would like to do, and maybe I'll, before we release this as PDF, I think it would be interesting to give as a player handout exactly that, right? A version of this map where the entire interior is scrubbed, so all you can see is the coastlines and a grid superimposed on it, so that you can use that as a handout to give to your players and go, here's the island. You can, as you explore it, feel free to fill in this map.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a good idea. And again, for me, my mega map was just doing the job as a battle map. And I think, I don't know, maybe I don't talk about it, but I think I generally do something like that. The last time I ran, I think it was around the last time I ran the Against the Giant series, I think is when the light bulb went off, and I consistently did that all the time. So for steadying the Hill Giant Chief, right, there's kind of a complicated outdoor stockade, and I gave him the outline of the whole stockade with the possible entry points. And for the Glacial Rift and the Fire Giant King areas, same point of like indicating where the entry, particularly like the really complicated glacial rift. I gave them the starting views of what their options were. And you and I talked about this a little bit at the end of the con, I think, of, I think it's a good idea, if you're not doing that, at least tell the mapper where to start drawing. Of like your entry, you should start drawing in the middle top of your graph paper. And I think one of our players was talking about, if you don't do that, it's very likely that they're going to immediately need a second piece of paper because they're going the wrong direction. So you can make that, you can just make life a little bit easier on everybody by tell them where to start mapping.
Yeah.
And then for an outdoor thing like this, the perimeter, that's really kind of a slam dunk idea.
I like still having a little bit of separation there, right? And I liked, it reminds me, honestly, of the birthday game that we talk about a lot of times.
Yeah.
Way back then, right, what I was doing is I had a projector in the ceiling pointed down on the tabletop so that I could just, you know, reveal parts of the map. But it wasn't like a zoomed out full view of the whole dungeon map, right? It was a close up. And yes. it was just a very cheap way for me to not have to constantly draw and erase and draw and erase on the battle mat. I could just shift things around. And now I think you, Dan, still had graph paper and were still then transcribing shapes and like assembling the whole map as you went. And I really like that. I like that sort of like, I don't have to waste a ton of time describing shape and outline. And, you know, it does feel a little rote to me sometimes when I start, especially if I'm playing with a player who's very actively mapping, to get into that habit of like, you open the door and then the first thing I have to say is it's a 30 by 50 room, 30 feet east, west, 50 feet north, south. You're entering from the north. Room or the north wall, the doors in the center of the wall, right? Like all these so many words to explain this basic shape and outline. I'd much rather just show it. Especially when you're like a room like 7 or 11 where the shape is weird.
Totally. And the fact that my players entered the very first thing they did at 7 was like, oh, I'm so glad I prepped the battle map. Because they're coming in one of the entryways. They can't see the whole thing, right? They're coming in by surprise. Mm-hmm. There's a particular cone of their vision cone. One person's got a lantern, one's a dwarf. They've got infravision. And so with all the, you know, the multiple exits and the multiple alcoves and all that kind of thing, I was just like, I'm so glad I can do it this way right now.
Now, I assumed Area 7 would be pretty well lit because I'd assume lots of sunlight's coming in there from the north side of the map.
Interesting. Well, see, this is one of these things. I was a little I was a little prickly on that, but you know, they had a person going in with infravision to begin with. They're monsters, they've got infravision. I tend to like assume they're living in the dark a little bit. I was like a little bit of light coming in.
Fascinating.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, so interesting. You see, it's moments like this, Dan, where I'm like, I'm certain that Dan is just a much harder ass DM than me. And yet somehow, I guess maybe I might be wrong about that.
We had such a unique element of our playtests, and it's never happened before, and I've never heard of anybody else having this happen. But one of the things that happened at RPGCon last week is that one of our friends, Ragnar, and he's also a patron. I don't know if he's in the chat today or not. But our friend Ragnar signed up to both playtests. But what the one player was in both of our playtests. And on the one hand, they were scrupulous about not seeing the design session. They came in, they said hi. They said, I'm going to specifically not watch the design session, so I at least have one run where I don't know what we're getting into at all. Ran, you know, was one of the players on Saturday in my game, and then turned around and was also a player Sunday in Paul's game. So for the first time ever, we do actually have one person who experienced both of our play styles in the exact same dungeon in the exact same weekend with two different groups. And of course, Ragnar was a little bit more active on the Saturday. And then on Sunday came in and said, look, I'm going to take more of a back seat because I think I know many of the puzzles and traps and stuff like that. And so Ragnar, I think this is invaluable, took time on our Discord server and wrote up his experiences and kind of compared and contrast our two styles. And so kind of went through the overall play action that we talked about here. And then his conclusion, I'm just reading it right here from our Discord server. It was definitely fun seeing the nuanced differences in how Paul and Dan ran the same adventure. Some strong commonalities, but some neat variances too. Both gave excellent descriptions in play, though I think Paul is a little subtler in hiding his clues and is arguably a little tougher in adjudication. Not in a bad way, still great. Although Dan loves hyping up the dangers and trying to put the fear to us, I'd be tempted to say that he's a little softer, more generous. Although there are exceptions, like the oil thing, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was surprised by that. That was not the take that I expected. And what a wild, this is why you do this for those kinds of surprises, because I would not have thought that would be the takeaway at all.
I've always assumed that I've been playing catch up to be right? as hard ass DM as Dan. So that's fascinating. That is absolutely fascinating to hear that. Yeah. I wonder now, Dan, if this isn't though that you know, you are leaning, I think you lean a little bit more, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is my perception, but I think you've got the battle mat, you're going to lean a little more wargame-ish style there, right? Yes. I think you lean a little more into things like secret door checks and that kind of stuff, whereas I always see those kinds of roles as the ultimate fallback. Like, I want the players to interact with the environment, right? And so if they say, right, like I said, the cases where I want to hear them say, oh, I feel around the walls, and I go, great, we're not going to roll dice, this is what you find, right?
Okay. Wow. Okay.
And then I'm not going to go to the dice until they're really insistent about, like, no, we really spread out and we really feel every square inch of the walls, and I go, okay, well then we're going to roll dice.
Got it. Yeah, I had, you know, there was a trap, there was a kind of a key trap on a door that we placed, and the halfling thief was checking all the doors, and, you know, those rolls I make in secret, those kinds of detection rolls, and absolutely, I rolled it, and they just flat out failed it. And, you know, 5 minutes later, I get to say, well, you know what, 5 minutes ago, you did your best, but you absolutely missed that trap, and now you're getting slammed by it.
That's funny.
So now, I will say
an interesting one to compare might be the ghouls at 5. So one of my players had an intelligent sword with the ability to detect traps. Invaluable, right? Yeah. Immediately, like, just like they open the door, sword says, yep, there's definitely a trap. If you step in between these alcoves, you're gonna die. They figure it out, they disable it, they move on. They get towards area 5 and they ask the sword any traps, and I think to myself, and this is, I really had to think a lot with the stupid detecting trap sword in this adventure, and I thought, no, I think there's no traps here, because I don't think that is a trap. I think that's a monster lurking, waiting to jump out at you and kill you, but I wouldn't call it a trap. Do you agree or disagree with that call, Dan?
I agree. I actually agree with that. Yeah, it's not, you know, and if somebody else said something different, it's not an insane thing to say, but I would rule the same way as what you just said.
Yeah, so they've got various detection skills, so they're feeling pretty confident coming past. So I think that maybe they also had a detect magic going, and I'm like, is there magic here? No, there's ghouls behind them. I described the metal plates. I'm like, there's these plates, clearly some kind of crypty space here, right, where there's maybe someone entombed beyond these plates, and they go, oh, that's weird, and then they push on. I'm like, okay, great, well. As soon as you pass by, they pop open and they try to grab you.
Great. I basically rule the same. Now, I will say, this is great because you and I had not talked about how you ran the ghoul trap at 5 there before. Now, I will say, you know, just again, totally invaluable having Ragnar's observations there. It is a sample size of 1. So it is one particular adventure on one particular day. And, you know, so I was thinking about that, like, you know, am I doing a lot of kayfabe stuff? Am I doing a lot of, you know, like, I'm a horrible DM and I want you all to die when I secretly really don't, right? Again, I'm secretly really a big fan of the players and the characters. And that's why I want a bunch of guardrails to guide me that I don't cheat in their favor. The other thing now is, you know, so we had this conversation the last episode, actually, about how many magic items should we give our pre-generated characters? And again, this is an adventure for basically 6th level PCs. My fighters and wizards are 6th level, and my thieves are 7th level, for what it's worth. And I made coming off that conversation last time, I made brand new player characters. I followed your idea, Paul, of having the same party represented possibly at different levels and taking the opportunity the week in advance to, you know, and I rolled some dice and then kind of massaged, right? I didn't want them totally homogeneous. So I was using some dice rolls over the levels. I kind of massaged it a little bit so there was something interesting happening at each level for everybody. Now maybe I might arguably have them with too much magic, maybe. Possibly. And two things that I could point to is that the sixth level, I got a sixth level fire wizard, and the dice kind of told me to give him a wand of fireballs at that point. He got kind of lucky with some rolls, and I gave him a wand of fireballs with four charges. So for what it's worth, he morally, and he and the player used it very, very wisely. He basically opened any important fight with a fireball on the boss. So very first round with the lizard men, immediately blew up the lizard man wizard, never got any spells off. First round with the spirit naga, fireball. First round with the vampire, fireball, wiped out the cockatrice parrot, right? And I'm like, maybe there's a bit. And then the second thing is that Ragnar had kind of a rangery fighter that had a bag of tricks. And if you remember what that does, you can reach your hand in there, pull out a little fur ball, and then it turns into some kind of animal like a tiger or a lion or a bear or something like that. And Ragnar used that really great against all the traps. So any place that they thought maybe there's a trap, whoop, throughout, you get the green, the horrible green slime floating in water. Whoop, here comes a lion. Check it out. Immediately melts into green slime. Well, now we know that. Whoop, throw it out into the flying blades, right? Well, just bisects the lion. It's dead, but now we know what that is. And at the ghouls, the thing slid. They'd walked past it. They slid open. I tried to roll a surprise check. It didn't work. And then the next thing is, we're going to throw a bear in on it. So he chucked a bear into the ghoul thing, and there was just like a whole fight, a silent fight for what it's worth, right? Nice. But the bear basically took care of at least one of the ghouls. So
you know, I wonder so now. I'm trying to think back into the magic items. Into the actual ghoul fight that happened in my game, and I almost think I might have forgotten about the silence part. I honestly can't remember. No, that said, I want to push back on. I don't think that you've overdone it with the magic. I do think that potentially bag of tricks might just be better than a sword that can detect traps at will, because that was the one that kept breaking my head of like, oh, I kept ruling against it of like, well, I don't think it detects the ghouls, and I don't think it detects the giant snakes lurking in the fog. Like I don't think those are traps. Those are just natural perils. And for what it's worth, my party, of course, had an intelligence sword with detect traps. They had a broom of flying, which they used to ferry their people across the and never even deal with the slime because they were just able to ferry right across it. They had the helm of underwater action, which completely spoiled the mermaid's ability to surprise them. It was a fair amount of magic. Right. And for what it's worth, in my stack of characters, as you know, I always have more characters than players. I absolutely have a wizard with a wand of fireballs. Totally have that also. They just
Okay. No, okay.
They just decided not to choose him. What I always do in these games, because I think this is fun, a little bit of fun for me. Anytime one of my pre-gens has a wand, I don't write the number of charges, and at the table I'll have the player roll a d10, and that's the number of charges they get for that game.
Got it.
Which is delightful.
Yeah, I can.
It's one, and sometimes it's eight, and all over the place.
Interesting. I love it. Interesting. Yeah, I decided on that one. I could recognize that as potentially powerful enough, particularly at sixth level, that I wanted to dial it in. So I mean, for what it's worth, it was a D4 plus one that I rolled, came up with four. And you know what? After that first playthrough, I've dialed it down to three for what it's worth. Three seems to be like the magic number, but entirely what I was doing there was, you know, traditionally in you go all the way back to chainmail. Right, wizards either they can cast infinite fireballs, they can cast infinite lightning bolts, which I interpret in Book of War as having a wand. So I have one wizard that at some point they're going to have a wand of fireballs, and at a higher level, the other wizard's going to have a wand of lightning. Is what I was doing with that. So I was like, it was kind of borderline for me, but I was like, you know what, I want somebody with a lot of fire. So
Yeah, I mean, as Backwiz points out in the chat, wands are tricky in one shots because the
it is true.
Players are just going to empty them. They're just going to empty them, right? Which they would never do totally in a real campaign. They would guard those, but they're so precious. Every charge must be worth it. Right?
Yeah. Likewise, you know, if you look at the bag of tricks, I'm sorry, you look at the bag of tricks in advanced D&D. They've got a limit of you can use it 10 times per week. So same thing. I'm gonna clearly burn up all 10 times in my one shot.
At the beginning of the show, Dan, you mentioned there was one encounter that you just is your favorite that you've ever run. Which one is it? I have to know.
Oh! Great. So, in room 11 with the statue, there's three alcoves, and we did one thing in the design session, and then this was a thing that we modified a little bit in the hotel room later at night, and then one of us had been at the bar for a while and didn't remember that we did that the next day. The statue can be, so what we've got it now at is the front door is trapped, and if you don't check the trap, it triggers a paralyzing fear gas that's going to happen 5 minutes later. And then there's a statue, and you can rotate it to point at any of the three alcoves, and one of the alcoves has a really spectacular treasure that opens up. One of the alcoves causes the doors to lock and a geyser of water to flood the room. And then the third one, really the first one, has a big aquarium tank behind it and releases a flood of 50 sea snakes. And this is one of these places where, you know, partly my thinking is we're using the classic sweep attacks. So if you are confronting one hit die or less monsters, our sixth level fighters get six attacks every round. So if you can throw a really enormous number of low-level monsters. You know, in our last one we did, we've got a giant number of piranha, right? And I did the same kind of thing of just like an enormous number of piranha I can throw at them. And potentially the fighters can chainsaw through them pretty well. So this is a place where late that night, I was thinking about what should the exact stats be for this giant number of snakes. And, you know, a long, long time ago, I have an article on my blog, which is basically whenever I have, in my experience, if I have a game design problem or dilemma, the best solution for me is always just do whatever happens in real life. Do some actual research about how people really deal with this. And inevitably, for me, that always comes up the best thing. So I was doing a little bit of research of how venomous are different types of snakes that night. And I'm like, you know, I don't want them to be all the immediate instant death like in classic D&D. So I was like, what are some snakes that are kind of a little bit venomous, right? And kind of dial it in. And so what I learned was sea snakes, right? Actual real world sea snakes in the tropics are venomous, but they don't always inject the venom when they bite. And so there's a lot of fishermen in those areas that are accustomed to, I pulled up a sea snake with my catch and I just grab it and maybe it bites me, no problem, I throw it back. And they're in that habit of actually routinely just grabbing the sea snake. But once in a great while, it does inject the venom and then you actually are in fact have a life-threatening problem. And I was like, isn't that interesting? So what I did, you know, and I've never seen this before for our sea snakes, is that when they bite you, they've got a 1 in 6 chance of injecting poison. So that kind of dials in. So this might possibly be kind of one of those things that Ragnar was talking about, because Ragnar is sitting, character is standing there when they point the statue there, opens up the valves, and just has a tsunami of water and snakes, right? Just water and hungry, angry snakes just wash over him. And I came around to the battle map. I don't know if you want to pull up that other photo briefly. And I had a handful of miniatures of like alligators and frogs. And, you know, I'm kind of loose with this. So, and I just dumped. So at this point, they're already half gone, right? If you're looking at the photo, yep. I didn't think to take a photo until they'd already cleared out fully half of them. But I just dumped this huge wad of miniatures on the table covering Ragnar's character and said, you know, everything you see here, that's two snakes. And they come out and they're hungry and they've got fangs and you can see they're all venomous. And potentially, if they bite you, instant death. And the, the players were like, are you kidding me? I say, potentially, every single one of them, they bite you instant death at that moment. So just be aware that's what's happening. And so they responded super well. And you can see on the far right, like the halfling character is actually kind of trapped in this alcove. There were snakes blocking them there. Ragnar's character was in the alcove on the top left, right? So initially they were caught there. And the players responded very intelligent. So very first thing, the wizard has a lightning bolt memorized, blasts a path from the door to that alcove where that they came out of on the left, and that gives a path for Ragnar's fighter to get back to the home base, right? And then there's a fireball from the wand that gets launched. Very efficient, super efficient. I don't have to roll for damage. Obviously, they just wipe out anything that it touches. So that gets wiped out. The dwarven fighter gets in the action. You can see at this point that they've formed a barrier, right? Like in the red cape, that's the dwarven fighter. So the two fighters have formed a barrier. They've got the wizard behind them about to cast a knock spell on the locked door, right? Snakes come up and it's six attacks, right? They're chopping through them. Not everyone hits. They're chopping through them greatly. And then the fear gas kicks in. And I go, oh, we're 5 minutes later. You're doing super well. You're doing so well. But unfortunately, the fear gas kicks in. I'm going to need all of you to make saving throws. And I believe that only, so they unlocked the door, but I believe that Ragnar can possibly remind me in the chat. I think only Ragnar's character made the save because his fighter has this iron will feat, which gives a save to fear type stuff. Everybody, particularly that dwarven fighter, he's got magic plate mail. He's got a magic shield. He's got an armor class of -2. I cannot hit him, basically, right? I need natural 20s to hit him. He gets paralyzed, and I go, okay, little reminder, everybody, in our rules, classic D&D rules, if you're paralyzed, you get automatically hit. Automatically hit. I go, oh, my plate mail. I'm sorry. The rules are the rules. Automatically hit. Yeah. So I think this is maybe a second ago, right after this photo is taken. So here come as many snakes as I can fit on you. There's six snakes. Yep. You get hit six times automatically, and now I'm doing the 1 in 6 chance for poison. And I pick up six excited dice. I go, every time I roll a 1 here, you're being injected with poison.
Yep.
Roll them on. Everybody's very interested in this dice roll at this point. No ones show up.
No ones.
Not a single one. I go, you're in luck. No poison is ejected. And Ragnar's fighter finishes off the remaining snakes. And I was delighted with that. I was so delighted with just the spectacle of this, just dumping as many miniatures as I can get my hands on. The players very intelligently using area and sweep attacks to really reduce them really fast. Yeah. And then the fear gas and then the automatic possible poison hits was really exciting. And that's one of my favorite encounters I have ever run.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you kind of hit all the notes just right in just the right sequence, right, for that to happen. This is nothing like what happened to my group in this room. Nothing at all. I'm now curious about the basically two snakes per miniature. So was that allowing you to get more attacks in than you normally would allow because of adjacency for placement?
Yeah, but that makes sense because they're kind of smaller, right? So I think, like, if you look at the advanced D&D rules, you should have two things per space.
I mean, that's,
so
that's I think the thing that enters my head, right? And again, this is maybe why Ragnar thinks I'm a harsher GM, where I'm like, they're snakes. They're normal-sized snakes. Like, they should just be all over you. Like, I should get lots of attacks. A lot of 50 snakes? Yeah, you should be able to be swarmed by, I don't know, at least half of them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's totally legitimate.
If the two per miniature was that just because that's how many miniatures you had, or was that something you thought out ahead of time?
It was a comment. Well, I mean, I thought it out about a minute before. I was like, oh, this is about to happen, and I'm over on my behind the screen going, what can I do with miniatures? Kind of look sort of right and fit and all that kind of stuff. So it was exactly 1 minute before it happened that I decided on that. But that's what I had, and it fits in the space, and it's like, okay, this is what's happening.
Would you continue to do that, or would you tune it all? Would you want, you know, five snakes per miniature, or four snakes per miniature, or a different number, or is two feel
I like the right choice? I really like the spectacle of a lot of miniatures on the board. Yeah, so I would keep doing it like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't place them. I just literally dumped them. I just bam, them, wherever they are, that's where they land. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have that at all. My group, they came in through the secret door, so they didn't trigger the trap. They had the magic sword that told them that the door was trapped, so they were actually able to disable the fear gas. Never happened.
Got it.
They started mucking with the statue, and they got it to point to the treasure first, I think. So they're like, great, treasure, fantastic. They pointed to the next alcove, they got the water. They managed to have already found the scroll of lower water, so they used that to
get water at bay. Wow.
And then they decided at that point, we've pressed our luck enough. Let's leave.
Love it. Love it.
And there you go. That's basically how that room went for me. So not quite the experience you had. Now, on the other hand, I will say I adored the fight with the vampire pirate prince. Like, that was just, what a great fight. What a great monster that is. You've got a vampire who looks like a pirate who's wearing an eye patch and has a cockatrice for a parrot. He's got a magic like beam of cold energy that he can shoot out of his eye patch. I think in rapid succession in my attacks with these guys, I turned someone to stone with a cockatrice. I blasted someone with cold energy for a massive amount of damage. And then I started trying to charm one of their fighters over to join the pirate prince, right? With the just normal vampiric gaze. Did I do the charm? Maybe I didn't do the charm. Maybe then I tried to go in for a bite just to reveal that he was a vampire. Just
yes.
For horror.
Yeah, I can see why you want to do that.
Regardless, what a delightful, fun fight that was. And it was really overjoyed to see the party just quickly decide, you know what? We need to focus on the cockatrice first. That's the bigger threat.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, I love that element so much. We wouldn't have come up with that without audience input to kind of get us there. And there's something that I adore about that we have to focus on the supporting creature first.
Yeah, it's nice, really, right? When you have, like, I think we see this problem a lot, right? Where you have some big scary monster, but it's just one solo monster, right? So they quickly lose due to the whole action economy problem.
Yeah.
And so usually my tactic usually of dealing with that is like, okay, we'll give them a whole bunch of minions. You've got one big scary monster and they've got, you know, 20 guards or 10 guards or whatever. But actually, now that I think about it, maybe more fun to put two big scary monsters in. Just two is enough.
Just
to be like, yep.
Two is good.
Twist that action economy a little bit. And now you got to decide which one is more horrific.
Yeah. I agree. I like that. There are some suggestions from Gygax in the early like puzzle traps about like kind of two things, like a troll riding a rhinoceros beetle or something like that, or a troll and a slime. And there is something about that of just like, and the players have probably, you could probably pick any two nasty monsters, and the players have probably not thought through or not had an opportunity to practice against this particular combination, right? Yeah. So this will be a new thing. That's all it takes for this to be a novel encounter of like, I just love this dilemma of like, what do we take down first, the vampire or the cockatrice?
Yeah.
Which is worse? Yeah. That's not a standard D&D decision that you have to make. Yeah. On the fly.
It's nice. It's better, I think, than the like, oh, we have a shaman and a bunch of fightery types, because very quickly people will be like, well, take down the big boss, ignore the mass attacks from the low level guys, because who cares about them? No. Hit him with two nasty things. Yeah, love it. All right, Dan,
adore that. Amazing.
Any final thoughts on the Pleasure Palace of the Pirate Prince?
This is maybe possibly my favorite one to date. I like that. I'm liking it more all the time. As far as like things that I remember the Pumpkin King, because it's our only wilderness adventure. And also we did a marathon playthrough as co-DMs. I remember fondly the flying castle of the flying lich, or whatever we called it. Because I like high level challenges. I like the flying rock challenge, and then this is right up there. This is like a top three one of our dungeon design dashes. I had a blast with this. I love these encounters that we're coming up with. We were trying for a while and not managing to do the parallel playtests, And I am so happy that we're starting to actually execute on both of us running at the same weekend and then getting to compare experiences and make them better as a result. So I love game design, Paul. I love designing games, and I love getting to play through them with actual players, and I love getting the opportunity to iterate and make them better. And I'm not getting tired of this game design cycle, and I love doing it with you.
Awesome. Well, fantastic. Viewers, if you have any opinions on the Pleasure Palace of the Pirate Prince, if you've gotten to run it, please give us some thoughts. Tell us how it went for you. Comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe it's something we will revisit in the future.
Absolutely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub, and we have the handle Wandering DMs there. So please look for us there and muster that like button.
If you prefer to listen to this show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find it through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please consider giving us a 5-star review. That helps other viewers or other listeners find us, and we really
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where conversations about our games and other people's games and D&D and horror and miniatures and all the stuff that we adore is happening around the clock. And our patrons just give us so many great invaluable ideas to make our games better. You should get in there and take advantage the same way. We will be there to continue this conversation, because I have more things to say in about 10 minutes on our live video after chat. So we hope to see you there. And if you're a part of it or you have other questions we didn't get to, we would love to hear that in our one-on-one video after chat there. I'm still recovering. I'm still recovering from our busy convention cycle, right? So we actually had 3 total conventions in the last month. I was at 2 of them. So I'm personally still recovering in some ways from the excitement. And I'm sure that we'll probably continue to talk about that stuff in the future. So don't forget, we are live basically every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.